Welcome back to the deep dive. You're about to embark on a deep dive into the wild world of real estate contracts in California.
Oh, exciting.
I'm excited because you've provided a mountain of legal documents, contracts for buying,
wow,
selling, even inheriting property, I have to admit. Just glancing through them made my head spin a little.
It's true. They can be pretty dense.
Yeah.
But don't worry, we're going to break them down into bite-sized pieces and pull out the most important nuggets.
And I think what struck me most, even in my initial skim, was how much we take contracts for granted in real estate.
Yeah.
It's like this invisible web holding everything together.
That's a great analogy. Contracts really are the foundation of every real estate transaction.
Yeah.
They define the rules of the game, so to speak. Yeah. And knowing those rules can be the difference between a smooth closing and a legal nightmare.
Okay, so let's start with the basics.
Sure.
What exactly is a contract in the eyes of the law? It's more than just signing a piece of paper, right?
Right. It's not just a formality.
Yeah.
A contract is a legally binding agreement.
Okay.
A promise that can be enforced in court.
Got it.
And for it to be valid, it needs certain key ingredients.
Okay.
Think of it like baking a cake. If you leave out a crucial ingredient, it's just not going to work.
I like that analogy.
Good.
So what are these essential ingredients of a valid contract?
Well, first, you need parties who are capable of contracting.
Okay.
That means individuals who are legally allowed to enter into agreements.
Makes sense.
We're talking adults of sound mind, not, say, a five-year-old trying to buy a beach house.
Makes sense.
Right.
But I'm guessing there are some interesting exceptions, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Like, what about those rare cases where a minor might be legally allowed to buy or sell property?
You're absolutely right. There are exceptions.
Okay.
For example, in California, emancipated minors actually have certain powers to deal with real property.
Wow.
It's like a fast track to adulthood.
Okay.
But only for specific legal purposes.
Girl.
They can buy, sell, and even mortgage property just like an adult.
Wow. I had no idea. So it's not always as simple as just being 18.
Right.
Okay. That's parties capable of contracting.
Yes.
What's the next key ingredient?
Next up, you need mutual consent.
Okay.
This means a genuine meeting of the minds. Both parties must willingly and knowingly agree to the terms of the contract. And it's not enough for one party to just say yes to a vague or misleading offer.
Right.
Right.
So you're saying there has to be real clarity about what each side is promising?
Absolutely.
What's an example of where that meeting of the minds might be missing?
Let's say a developer offers to buy a piece of land contingent on obtaining permits.
Okay.
Sounds reasonable, right?
Yeah.
But what kind of permits? How long do they have to get them? What if they don't even try?
Right.
A court might look at that and say the offer was so vague that it wasn't a real commitment.
So even if both sides say yes, if the terms are too wishy-washy, it might not hold up as a valid contract. That's really important to remember.
It is.
Okay, what's the next essential ingredient?
The third element is lawful object.
Okay.
Basically, the contract can't involve doing anything illegal.
Right.
So no contracts to sell a property for use as, say, an illegal gambling den.
Seems pretty straightforward.
It does.
But I bet some people try to push the boundaries.
I'm sure they do.
Okay, what's the fourth essential element in our contract recipe?
It's sufficient consideration.
Okay.
This means something of value must be exchanged between the parties. Doesn't have to be a huge amount.
Okay.
But it has to be something that the law recognizes as having value.
Got it.
That's where that famous $1 consideration for an option contract comes in.
Wait, you're telling me you can buy the right to purchase a property for just a dollar?
You absolutely can. It might seem strange.
Yeah.
But it satisfies the legal requirement for consideration.
Okay.
The dollar represents a tangible, albeit small, exchange of value.
That's wild. So it's almost like a legal formality to show that both sides are putting something on the table, even if it's just a symbolic amount.
Exactly.
Okay, we've got our four main elements. Parties, consent, lawful object, and consideration.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier that there's a fifth element that's particularly crucial in real estate.
You got it.
Okay.
And that's proper writing.
Okay.
Most real estate contracts must be in writing to be legally enforceable.
Right.
This is due to a legal principle known as the statute of frauds.
Okay, I've definitely heard of the statute of frauds.
Yeah.
But to be honest, it always sounded a bit intimidating.
It can sound that way.
Can you break it down for us? Why is it so important in the world of real estate?
Imagine a world where you could just claim someone promised to sell you a house.
Oh, wow.
And they had no way to prove you wrong.
Yeah.
Talk about chaos.
Yeah.
The statute of frauds exists to prevent that kind of fraud and ensure there's clear evidence of agreements.
So it's all about creating a paper trail, a record of the deal that can be referenced if there's ever a dispute.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense, especially when you're talking about something as valuable as real estate.
Absolutely. And in California, the statute of frauds specifically requires written contracts for most real estate transactions.
Okay.
Think about it. The sale of a house, a lease for more than a year, even agreements between agents and clients about commissions. They all have to be put in writing.
Got it.
It protects everyone involved.
That's a relief to know there are these legal safeguards in place. Now, I'm guessing that even with these written contracts, disagreements can still arise.
Of course.
How do courts figure out what a contract really means if the language is unclear or the parties have different interpretations?
That's a great question.
Yeah.
One of the tools courts use is the parole evidence rule.
Okay.
It sounds complicated.
Yeah. It does.
But it's actually a pretty simple idea.
Okay.
It basically says that if you have a clear written contract, you can't use evidence of prior agreements or conversations to contradict what's in the document.
So it's like saying what's written is what counts.
Exactly.
No backsies. It keeps people from trying to change the terms of the deal after the fact.
Precisely. It helps prevent those he said, she said situations and make sure everyone is on the same page.
That's a good thing because I'm already sensing that things can get pretty complicated in the world of real estate contracts.
Yes, they can.
Now, we've been talking a lot about how contracts are created, but what about how they come to an end? What are some of the ways a contract can be discharged or completed?
Well, the ideal scenario is full performance.
Okay.
That means both parties have fully lived up to their obligations under the contract.
Right.
The buyer paid the seller, transferred the property, everyone's happy.
Right.
But there are other ways a contract can end.
Yeah.
And some of them aren't so happy.
Okay, so full performance is like the happy ending to the contract story. What are some of the less happy endings? What happens when one party doesn't hold up their end of the bargain?
That's when we start talking about breach of contract.
Okay.
It essentially means one party has failed to perform as promised.
Right.
It could be something major like the seller refusing to hand over the deed or something more nuanced, like missing a deadline for a key step in the process.
Okay, so a breach can be a big deal or a smaller hiccup.
Right.
But either way, it disrupts the smooth flow of the transaction.
Exactly.
What happens when there's a breach? What recourse does the wronged party have?
Well, they have several legal options.
Okay.
Each with different strengths and weaknesses.
Okay.
They could choose unilateral rescission, which basically means saying, okay, you broke the deal, so I'm calling it off.
Got it.
They could also sue for damages.
Okay.
Seeking financial compensation to make up for the losses caused by the breach.
So it's like they have a choice.
They do.
Walk away or fight for compensation.
Yes.
Are there any other remedies available?
Yes. And this one is particularly powerful in real estate.
Yep.
The wronged party can seek specific performance.
Okay.
This is where a court orders the breaching party to actually do what they promised in the contract.
Wow.
Rather than just paying money.
So if a seller tries to back out of the deal, the court could force them to go through with the sale.
Exactly. It's a powerful tool to protect the buyer's interests.
Yeah.
Especially since every piece of property is unique.
Right.
Money can't always truly replace a specific piece of land.
Right.
Particularly in California, where real estate is such a hot commodity.
That makes a lot of sense. It highlights how the law recognizes the special nature of real property.
It does.
Now, I know we're just laying the groundwork here.
Right.
But I'm already seeing how much complexity there is in these real estate contracts.
Oh, there is.
And we've just been talking about general contract principles.
Yes.
What about some of the specifics that are unique to real estate?
You're right. There's a whole other layer of complexity when we start looking at the specific types of contracts commonly used in California real estate transactions.
Oh, boy.
We've got everything from listing agreements to options, exchange agreements.
Yeah.
And those all important deposit receipts.
Okay, I'm ready to dive into those specifics.
Sure.
Let's move beyond the legal theory and start exploring how these contracts play out in the real world.
Sounds good.
Where should we start?
Let's begin with one of the most fundamental documents in a real estate transaction.
Okay.
The listing agreement.
Okay.
It's the contract between a seller and a real estate broker that sets the stage for the whole selling process.
Great. Let's unpack that.
Okay.
Welcome back to the deep dive. In part one, we covered the essential elements of contracts, those crucial ingredients that make a contract legally binding.
Right.
Now let's zoom in on the specific types of contracts
yes.
that drive real estate deals here in California.
Right. And there's a whole ecosystem of contracts, each with its own purpose and quirks.
We ended part one talking about the listing agreement.
Yes.
Which feels like the official kickoff to selling a property.
It is.
Can you walk us through the anatomy of a good listing agreement? What should sellers be paying attention to?
Well, a good listing agreement needs all those essential contract elements we talked about.
Yeah.
Capable parties, mutual consent, lawful object consideration, and proper writing.
Right.
But it goes beyond that.
Okay.
It's like a roadmap for the seller-broker relationship, outlining the broker's authority and responsibilities.
Okay. So it's about defining who does what.
Right.
What kind of details does that roadmap usually include?
It should clearly spell out what the broker is authorized to do on behalf of the seller.
Okay.
Things like advertising the property, mm-hmm. arranging showings, and presenting offers.
Right.
You don't want any ambiguity about those core duties.
Right. Because it's a partnership, and both sides need to be on the same page about their roles.
Exactly.
What else should a solid listing agreement cover?
It should clearly state the listing price.
Okay.
The commission rate the broker will earn, and the duration of the agreement.
Right.
You'd be surprised how often these seemingly basic things cause problems down the line if they're not spelled out clearly up front.
It's like those home renovation shows where they find out they didn't agree on the budget beforehand.
Okay.
And suddenly everyone's yelling, okay, so clarity is key.
Yes, it is.
What are some red flags that sellers should watch out for in a listing agreement?
One big one is a vague or overly broad description of the property.
Okay.
It needs to be very precise.
Okay.
Referencing official records and surveys.
Yeah.
To avoid any confusion about what's actually being sold.
Why is that so important? It seems like a small detail.
You'd be amazed how many disputes arise from fuzzy property descriptions.
Really?
Imagine a buyer thinks they're getting a detached garage.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out it's legally considered part of the neighbor's property. Those kinds of situations can turn into major legal headaches.
Ah, so it's all about preventing those gotcha moments.
It is.
What other potential traps should sellers be aware of?
Pay close attention to the termination clause.
Okay.
This outlines how and when the agreement can be ended.
Right.
Some agreements might automatically renew if you don't actively terminate them.
Oh, wow.
Which could lock you in longer than you intended.
So it's like those gym memberships that are impossible to get out of.
Exactly.
You really need to read the fine print and understand your exit options.
You do.
Okay, we've covered the listing agreement, which is all about authorizing the broker.
Yes.
What about the document that brings the buyer and seller together?
Right.
And defines the terms of the actual purchase?
In California, that's the deposit receipt.
Okay.
It's the heart and soul of a real estate sale.
Uh-huh.
Outlining the essential terms.
Okay.
Like purchase price, closing date, and any contingencies.
So it's basically the playbook for the sale.
It is.
What are some of the must-have elements that should always be in a deposit receipt?
First, it needs to clearly identify the parties.
Okay.
Both the buyer and the seller.
Uh-huh.
And of course, it needs a precise legal description of the property.
Right.
We can't stress that enough.
Okay, so you're making sure everyone knows exactly who's involved.
Yes.
And what property we're talking about.
Right.
What about the money stuff?
Right.
How are those details handled in the deposit receipt?
The deposit receipt should clearly state the purchase price.
Okay.
The earnest money deposit amount.
Okay.
And the financing terms.
Okay.
It should also specify the closing date and any conditions that need to be met.
Okay.
Before the sale can be finalized.
What do you mean by conditions? Can you give some examples?
Think of them as safety nets for the buyer.
Okay.
Common ones are financing contingencies,
uh-huh.
which protect the buyer if they can't secure a mortgage.
Right.
And home inspection contingencies,
okay.
which allow them to back out if a professional inspection reveals major problems.
So these contingencies give the buyer a way out if things don't go according to plan.
They do.
That makes sense. What are some common pitfalls to look out for in deposit receipts?
Sure.
What kind of things can trip up even experienced buyers or sellers?
One thing to be wary of is vague or ambiguous language.
Okay.
You want everything to be crystal clear.
Right.
For example, if the closing date is stated as on or about a certain date,
mm-hmm.
that can cause disputes about when the deal is actually supposed to happen.
So being specific about those key dates and deadlines is essential.
It is.
What other red flags should people be on the lookout for?
Buyers need to be very careful with as-is clauses.
Okay.
Which basically mean the seller is selling the property in its current condition.
Yeah.
With no guarantees about hidden problems.
Right.
It can be tempting to go for a lower price with an as-is clause.
Uh-huh.
But buyers need to be aware that they're assuming all the risk.
It's like buying a used car. You might get a deal, but you're also rolling the dice on potential repairs.
Exactly.
Okay, we've covered listing agreements and deposit receipts,
yes,
which are the bread and butter of most real estate transactions.
Right.
But there are some more specialized contracts out there, right?
There are.
What can you tell us about options?
Okay.
That always sound a bit mysterious to me.
Options are fascinating.
Okay.
They give a potential buyer the exclusive right.
Okay.
But not the obligation.
Okay.
To buy a property within a certain time frame at a predetermined price.
So it's like reserving the right to buy.
It is.
Without fully committing.
Right.
What's the catch?
The buyer, or option A, pays the seller.
Uh-huh.
Or optioner.
Okay.
A fee for this, right?
Okay.
It's like putting a down payment on the possibility of buying the property later.
What kind of situations are options typically used for?
They're often used in complex development deals.
Okay.
Where a developer might need time to secure permits or financing,
yeah,
before committing to the purchase.
Right.
It's a way to minimize risk while exploring a potential project.
So it gives the buyer a chance to do their homework and make sure the deal makes sense,
right,
before jumping in head first. What are some of the key things to watch out for in an option contract?
Well, obviously the price and the option period,
uh-huh,
which is the time frame the option is valid for,
right,
need to be clearly stated.
Yeah.
But it's also crucial to understand the conditions for exercising the option. What steps the buyer needs to take to actually trigger the purchase.
And I'm guessing time is of the essence with options, right?
It is.
If you miss that window of opportunity,
yes,
you could be out of luck.
Exactly. Once the option period expires, the seller is free to sell the property to someone else.
Right.
It's a use it or lose it kind of situation.
Okay. So options can be a strategic tool for certain buyers.
Yes.
But they come with their own set of rules and deadlines.
They do.
What about another specialized type of contract exchange agreements?
Okay.
I've heard these can be really complicated.
They can.
Even for seasoned real estate pros.
Exchange agreements definitely aren't for the faint of heart.
Okay.
They involve swapping one property for another without a traditional cash transaction. It's like a sophisticated barter system for real estate.
I'm intrigued. Why would someone choose to do an exchange instead of just selling and buying separately? Seems like it would add a whole layer of complexity.
The big draw is the tax advantage.
Okay.
Exchanges can allow you to defer capital gains taxes.
Okay.
That you'd normally have to pay when you sell a property for a profit.
Right.
So it can be a powerful way to build wealth and acquire new assets without taking a big tax hit.
That sounds like a great perk for savvy investors.
Right.
But what are some of the challenges of structuring these exchange agreements?
Yeah.
They must be pretty tricky to pull off successfully.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
One of the key challenges is making sure the properties being exchanged are of comparable value.
Oh.
Cool. The IRS has strict rules about this.
All right.
To prevent people from using exchanges as a way to dodge taxes.
Got it.
It has to be a genuine swap of similar value properties.
Right.
Not a disguised sale.
So there's a lot of scrutiny to make sure these exchanges are legitimate. What are some common types of exchanges?
The most well-known is the 1031 exchange.
Correct.
Named after the section of the tax code that governs it.
Got it.
This allows you to defer taxes by exchanging one investment property for another of like kind.
Okay.
But it has to be done within a specific time frame.
Yeah.
And following strict guidelines.
Okay. So 1031 exchanges are like the gold standard for real estate investors.
They are.
Looking to minimize their tax burden.
Right.
But it sounds like it's crucial to have a knowledgeable team on your side.
Yes.
To navigate all those rules and regulations.
Absolutely. Exchange agreements can be a fantastic tool.
Uh-huh.
But they require expert guidance from real estate professionals and tax advisors to make sure everything is done by the book.
We've covered a lot of ground in this deep dive.
We have.
Exploring the different types of contracts that shape the California real estate landscape.
Right.
But one theme keeps coming up.
Yeah.
The need for precision and clarity in the language of these agreements.
You're absolutely right. When it comes to real estate contracts, every word matters.
Yeah.
Vague language, missing terms, or sloppy drafting can lead to costly disputes, delays, and even deals falling apart.
It's a good reminder that these contracts are legally binding documents.
They are.
And you need to treat them with care.
Exactly. Whether you're a seasoned investor or a first-time homebuyer, it's crucial to approach these contracts with a critical eye.
Right.
Seek expert advice when needed.
Yeah.
And make sure you fully understand the terms before signing on the dotted line.
Excellent advice.
Thank you.
And speaking of things that can go wrong, in part three of this deep dive, we're going to tackle the thorny issue of breach of contract.
All right.
We'll explore what happens when those carefully crafted agreements are broken and what legal remedies are available to the wronged party.
Okay, sounds good.
Buckle up. Things are about to get interesting. Welcome back to the deep dive. We've spent the last two parts exploring the essential elements of contracts and the specific types of agreements that are common in California real estate.
Right.
But let's face it, sometimes things don't go according to plan.
Absolutely.
So in this final part,
yeah,
we're going to tackle those dreaded what-if scenarios.
Okay.
What happens when a real estate contract is broken?
Right. It's like the dark side of real estate transactions.
Yeah.
We've been talking about these contracts as tools for smooth and predictable deals.
Right.
But the reality is that disputes and breaches can happen even with the best intentions.
So let's talk about breach of contract. What does that actually mean in the context of real estate?
It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
A breach of contract occurs when one party fails to perform their obligations as outlined in the agreement.
Okay.
It could be something major, like a seller refusing to close on the sale.
Right.
Or something seemingly minor, like missing a deadline for a crucial step in the process.
So it's essentially breaking a promise that was made in the contract.
It is.
What are some of the most common reasons for breaches in real estate deals? Is it usually intentional, or are there situations where it's more of an honest mistake?
It really runs the gamut.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a deliberate decision, like a seller getting a better offer and deciding to back out of the original deal.
Right.
But often it's more about circumstances changing.
Okay.
A buyer might lose their job and suddenly be unable to qualify for a mortgage.
Right.
Or a seller might discover a major issue with the property that they weren't aware of before.
So life happens, and sometimes those carefully laid plans fall apart.
Absolutely.
It's a good reminder that these transactions involve real people with real lives, not just abstract legal documents.
Yes.
Okay, let's say a breach does occur. What are the options for the wronged party?
Okay.
How can they protect their interests?
Well, they have a few tools in their legal arsenal.
Okay.
The simplest option is just to accept the breach and walk away. This might make sense if the breach didn't cause significant harm,
mm-hmm.
or if pursuing legal action seems too costly or time-consuming.
So sometimes it's better to cut your losses and move on.
It can be.
But what if the wronged party feels like they've been seriously harmed by the breach? What other options do they have?
They can sue for damages, seeking financial compensation to make up for their losses.
Okay.
This could include recouping lost deposits, covering expenses they incurred in preparing for the transaction,
mm-hmm.
or even recovering the difference between the contract price and the current market value of the property if the market has shifted in their favor.
So it's about making the wronged party whole again, financially speaking, as if the breach had never happened.
Right.
But is there any way to actually force the breaching party to fulfill their original obligations rather than just paying money?
Yes. And this is where the remedy of specific performance comes in.
Okay.
It's a powerful legal tool that allows a court to order the breaching party to do what they promised in the contract.
I remember we touched on this earlier. Why is specific performance so important in real estate, as opposed to just accepting money as compensation?
Because, as we've discussed, real estate is unique.
Right.
Each property has its own distinct characteristics, and a simple financial payout might not fully compensate for the loss of that specific property, especially in a market like California, where certain properties are highly sought after.
Right.
Money can't always truly replace the opportunity that was lost.
It's almost like the legal system acknowledging that sometimes a deal is about more than just dollars and cents.
Yeah.
There's an emotional component to real estate.
Absolutely.
A sense of place and potential that can't always be quantified. But are there any limitations on when specific performance can be granted? It sounds like a pretty powerful weapon.
It is powerful, but it's not a guaranteed remedy. Courts will only grant specific performance if certain conditions are met.
Okay.
The contract has to be valid and enforceable.
Okay.
The terms need to be clear and unambiguous.
Yeah.
And the party seeking specific performance must have acted in good faith throughout the process.
So there's a legal bar to clear.
There is.
And it's not just a matter of snapping your fingers and demanding the other party comply. Now, I know that even with carefully crafted contracts, disputes can still arise in real estate transactions.
Of course.
What are some of the most common triggers for these legal battles?
One of the biggest sources of conflict is disagreements over the condition of the property.
Okay.
A buyer might discover undisclosed defects after the sale is finalized.
Oh, right.
Leading to a dispute about who's responsible for repairs or whether the seller misrepresented the condition of the property.
It's like those horror stories you hear about people buying a dream home only to find out later that it's riddled with hidden problems.
Exactly.
What other issues commonly spark legal disputes in real estate?
Boundary disputes are another classic.
Okay.
Neighbors might have different understandings of where their property lines actually lie.
Right.
Leading to arguments over fences, landscaping,
yeah,
or even building encroachments.
Those can definitely get heated, especially in areas where property values are high and people are very protective of their land.
They can.
It's a reminder that even seemingly simple things like property boundaries can become major points of contention.
Yes.
What about disputes that stem from the contracts themselves? I'm guessing unclear language or missing terms can create a legal minefield.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If a contract is poorly written,
yeah,
ambiguous, or missing key details, it can be incredibly difficult to determine what the parties actually agreed to.
Right.
That uncertainty creates fertile ground for disagreements and potential litigation.
It all circles back to that importance of precision and clarity in contract drafting that we've been talking about.
It does.
Every word matters. Now, let's say a real estate dispute does escalate to a full-blown legal battle.
Okay.
What are some of the common legal strategies used to resolve these conflicts? Is it always a dramatic courtroom showdown?
Not necessarily. There are actually several different paths to resolution, each with its own pros and cons.
Okay.
One common approach is mediation.
Okay.
This involves a neutral third party, the mediator,
yeah,
who helps the parties try to reach a mutually acceptable agreement. It's a more collaborative and less adversarial approach than going to court.
So it's like having a referee who can help facilitate communication and find common ground.
It is.
What if mediation doesn't work? What's the next step in the legal process?
If mediation fails, the parties might opt for arbitration.
Okay.
This is a more formal process where a neutral arbitrator,
yeah,
often a retired judge or an attorney with expertise in real estate law, hears evidence and makes a binding decision to resolve the dispute.
So it's like a private trial.
It is.
But often less expensive and time-consuming than going through the full court system.
Right.
And if all else fails, there's always the option of filing a lawsuit and going to court.
Right. Exactly. Litigation is the most formal and often the most expensive way to resolve a real estate dispute.
Yeah.
It involves all the bells and whistles of the legal system, filing pleadings, presenting evidence,
yeah,
and having a judge or jury decide the outcome.
It sounds like there's a whole spectrum of options for resolving these disputes, from informal mediation to a full-blown court battle.
There is.
It's a lot to navigate, and I'm starting to see why having a knowledgeable real estate attorney on your side can be so valuable.
You've hit the nail on the head, whether you're buying, selling, or just dealing with a property issue.
Right.
It's crucial to consult with qualified real estate professionals,
yeah,
including attorneys,
yes,
to protect your interests and make sure you're on solid legal ground.
Well, listeners, we've reached the end of our deep dive into the world of real estate contracts in California. We've covered a lot of ground.
We have.
From the basic elements of contracts to the nuances of specific agreements and even the sometimes messy realities of breaches and disputes.
We've explored the legal framework that governs these transactions.
Yeah.
The key terms and clauses to watch out for. And the importance of clear and precise language in contract drafting. Hopefully, you've gained a better understanding of the intricate dance between legal principles and practical considerations in the world of real estate.
And remember, this is just the beginning of your journey into the fascinating world of real estate contracts. As you continue to explore the market, whether as a buyer, seller, or simply an interested observer, keep these insights in mind and don't hesitate to seek expert advice when needed.
Until next time, happy house hunting.
Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive.